began Leviticus chapter 11 last time, and we're going to continue this week. The study of chapter 11 centers around the subjects of clean versus unclean and holy versus common. Now, it's interesting to me that it is only Judaism where these words are used regularly and where the common religious person has at least some education in their meaning. If you use these same words around modern day Christian believers, you'll get blank stares. And some will wonder out loud whether those terms, other than maybe the term holy, are even in the Bible. But the subject is central to the Judeo-Christian faith. And the lack of understanding, equally central to the weakness of the church of this age, comes together here. And we're going to see it. Let's see if we can't delve a little bit further into this matter today. Maybe we can take a step towards recovering these key God principles that have been lost. The final case we discussed in our last meeting had to do with a dead animal, like a common house mouse, coming into contact with some object like a pot or a bowl, and thus transmitting the uncleanness of death onto that object. So the question becomes, now that something has become polluted with an unclean dead animal, what's to be done with that object? The next few verses will give us an answer to that, so let's reread the last half of Leviticus chapter 11 in order to get our bearings. Leviticus chapter 11. That is going to be page 120 in your complete Jewish Bible. We're going to start reading at, let's start at 29. The following are unclean for you among all the small creatures that swarm on the ground: the weasel, the mouse, and various kinds of lizards, the gecko, the land crocodile, the skink, the sand lizard, and the chameleon. They are unclean crawling creatures, and anyone who touches them when they are dead will be unclean until evening. Anything on which one of them falls when dead will become unclean: wooden utensil, article of clothing, leather sacking, any utensil used for work. It must be put into water, and it will be unclean until evening, then it will be clean. If one of them falls into a clay pot, whatever is in it will become unclean, and you are to break the pot. Any food permitted to be eaten that water from such a vessel gets on will become unclean, and any permitted liquid in such a vessel will become unclean. Everything on which any carcass part of theirs falls will become unclean. Whether it's an oven or a stove, it's to be broken into pieces. They are unclean, and it'll be unclean for you, although a spring or a cistern for collecting water remains clean. But anyone who touches one of their carcasses will become unclean. If any carcass part of theirs falls on any kind of seed to be sown, it is clean. But if water is put on the seed and a carcass part of theirs falls on it, it is unclean for you. If an animal of a kind that you were permitted to eat dies, whoever touches its carcass will be unclean until evening. A person who eats meat from its carcass or carries its carcass to wash his clothes, he'll be unclean until evening. Any creature that swarms on the ground is a detestable thing. It is not to be eaten. Whatever moves on its stomach, goes on all fours, has many legs, all creatures that swarm on the ground, you're not to eat them because they're a detestable thing. You are to not make yourselves detestable with any of these swarming, crawling creatures. Do not make yourselves unclean with them. Do not defile yourselves with them, for I am Adonai your God. Therefore consecrate yourselves and be holy, for I am holy. Do not defile yourselves with any kind of swarming creatures that moves along the ground, for I am Adonai who brought you up out of the land of Egypt to be your God. Therefore you are to be holy, because I am holy. Such then is the law concerning animals, flying creatures, all living creatures that move about in the water, all creatures that swarm on the ground. Its purpose is to distinguish between the unclean and the clean, and between the creatures that may be eaten and those that may not be eaten. Now, most Bible translations have the last half of verse 32 stating something to the effect of any article, any utensil made of wood or leather or article of clothing, something like that. But that's not really correct. In the original Hebrew, what is typically translated incorrectly as article or utensils is instead the word vessel. The Hebrew word keli specifically refers to a container of some kind, like a bowl or maybe a water pitcher made out of wood, something like that. Maybe even a wineskin. The idea to understand here is that the vessel is made out of something porous, so it's absorbent of what fills it up. The solution for cleaning such a vessel is that it can be dipped in water, that is, it can be washed with water, and after the ritual washing that lasts until sunset, the end of the current day, the beginning of the next, the vessel was considered to be ritually clean again. But, as we're told in verse 33, if a dead animal falls into an earthenware vessel, pottery, it has to be destroyed and never used again. The same goes for an earthenware oven or a stove that could become defiled. It has to be broken, no longer used. Exactly why that is, scholars aren't sure. Because glazing and firing of clay pots was a known technology in the land of Canaan at this time. And when glazed, the problem with porosity and absorption is largely solved. Yet, there's no mention of that in this verse, that one needs to distinguish between a fired vessel versus an unfired vessel. Well, the elaborateness of the Judaism purity regulations that developed over the centuries is staggering. An entire tractate in the Mishnah called Kelim is devoted to this sole subject. Okay, one of the keys to keep in mind to the minds of the sages, rather, was whether a dead creature fell into or onto a vessel. Most of the time, a creature falling onto a vessel meant the vessel could be washed. When it fell into the vessel, its contents had to be destroyed, and usually the vessel. Therefore, a lid on it was a pretty good defense against the most serious and expensive incidents of contact with a dead creature. Now, as might be expected, not only the vessel, but of course everything in it, was rendered unclean if a dead animal fell inside of it. However, this comes with a caveat that moisture must be present inside the vessel. That is, if there was dried grain inside the container, then all that was needed was to remove the dead animal, clean the vessel, and the dry grain itself was considered acceptable to eat. However, if the grain had water mixed with it, for instance, it was dough that had been left to rise, then the grain that formed the dough, so to speak, had to be disposed of. It seems that key to transmitting the pollution is water, or if this water This is a water pot or a wine vat, then all of the liquid had was defiled and it had to be destroyed. Verse 36 tells us that if a dead animal falls into a water cistern or a well or a spring, there is no transmission of pollution to the well, cistern, or spring. However, the unfortunate person assigned with the duty to remove the carcass, now they become unclean. What a deal. See, here's the principle about water. When it's attached to the earth, a cistern, a lake, a stream, a mikveh, The water cannot be made unclean. On the other hand, water put into a portable vessel, like a pot or a bucket, it can be made unclean because it's not attached to the earth any longer. You see the difference? This lends itself to explaining why it is that a ritually unclean person or thing can be made clean by being immersed into water, provided that water is attached to the earth. Water attached to the earth can't contract uncleanness. It can only lend its purity to what's unclean. Now, keep this in mind always, because if you do, it will help you understand many things about the Hebrews' ritual processes and even some of the reasons that Yeshua did what he did. Verse 28 tells us that dry seed for planting is not contaminated if a dead animal falls into it. However, if the seed has been dampened somehow, so it's ready for germination, then it's unclean and it can't be used. Then things switch a little bit in verse 39, because now clean animals are dealt with. And the idea is that death makes a normally clean thing, person, creature, unclean. So, for instance, if a goat, which is a clean animal, dies for some reason, the person who touches its carcass is unclean until sundown. Someone who eats this formerly clean but now dead animal also becomes unclean and must wash his garments. The same goes for someone who simply carries off the dead animal. Of course, the cause of the animal's death is the key to this. If the animal was slaughtered for a sacrifice or slaughtered for a meal, that's fine. No uncleanness exists. It's when the animal dies from disease or injury or accident or is killed by a predator that it contracts and transmits its uncleanness. Verses 41 through 44 again addresses this concept of shketz, which means abomination. And the instruction against eating any living creature that swarms, in Hebrew, sharats, is repeated. Now, obviously, this is a very serious matter that it would be repeated with just in a few verses. Snakes, frogs, lizards, rats, mice, crocodiles, anything that slithers on its belly, crawls on all fours, darts around. These are things that are forbidden. Why? Because for Jehovah's own good reasons, these things are detestable to him, we're told. And the one who disobeys and does eat these things then becomes detestable, so to speak, to God, at least temporarily. This is not something that any Hebrew, and certainly not any of us, ought to ever be labeled as. And verse 45 reminds us just why God has set up this stringent set of rules for Israel. He says, because I'm holy, you must be holy too. See, this goes back to the Genesis concept that God made man in his image. God is so holy, man's to be holy. As intelligent as a dog, a chimp, a dolphin can be, there appears to be no evidence scripturally or scientifically to show that any living creature, except for a human, has the ability to comprehend God and a spiritual world. This is unique to mankind above all other living creatures, all of whom Jehovah places great value. And this is one reason why men are permitted to by God to kill and eat other living creatures, but other living creatures are not permitted by God to kill and eat humans. It's a one-way street. The Bible sentences any animal which has killed a human being for any reason to death. This chapter ends with a postscript, which is typical for that region in those times. Just as this chapter began by telling Israel what it was that would be discussed, so now it concludes by reiterating the purpose of the just spoken laws and commandments. And it is that so that the Israelites might distinguish between the clean and the unclean foods, or as we learned in our Hebrew, tameh and tahor. It also involves a biblical concept that has largely been in the background since the book of Genesis, the concept of dividing, electing, and separating. Those who were here for the book of Genesis study might remember that principle, although it's been a while. So to sum it up, in the beginning, God went through a whole series. Think back to everything you ever read about Genesis. God went through a whole series of actions that divided, elected, and separated. He divided dry land from wet waters, separated them. He divided light from darkness. He divided evil from good. He divided daytime from nighttime. He divided the water vapor in the air from the condensed water that formed the seas. He separated them. He set the minor lights in the heavens, like stars, to designate and divide seasons. He created man, and he divided him and separated him from all other living creatures, just as he would eventually divide and elect and separate Israel away and above all other nations on earth. So this same process is at play in dividing, electing, and separating those foods humans may eat versus foods he may not. In fact, although the typical translation for verse 47 says something to the effect of, for distinguishing between the living things that may be eaten, it more literally says that there may be a separation between the clean and the unclean. Now, as we're becoming more familiar with the concepts of Torah and of Leviticus, we can see the important difference between the words distinguish between and separate. In a world that demands political correctness and a tolerance for all things, distinguishing is a much milder concept than separating. Or distinguishing can be seen as the preliminary step before one divides and separates. Yet in the original Hebrew Bible, it is quite emphatic that merely knowing the difference, which is the idea of the word distinguish, is worlds apart from acting on that knowledge, which is the idea of separating. We're not just to know, merely to distinguish good from evil, right from wrong. We're to separate the two of them. We're to stand firmly on the side of right and good, away from the side of wrong and evil. And this is much harder, isn't it? Takes an awful lot more commitment to do that. But that's exactly what is expected of those who are near to God. That's us. I want to point out something too. It's very important. I'm going to bring this up a number of times, but I want you to see this. Go back to verse 47 and take a quick look at this. talks about the law concerning all the foods and so on. What does it say? Its purpose is to distinguish between the clean and unclean, between the creatures that may be eaten and those that may be, those that may not be not. There is two sets of laws that will develop here. One that involves the distinguishing between the unclean and the clean, which is entirely different in principle and concept than creatures that may be eaten and those that may not be eaten. You with me? It's not the same thing. This is usually taught that saying clean and unclean is the same thing as saying distinguishing what creatures are okay to eat and distinguish. It's not. It's entirely different concepts that we're dealing with here. Because in the end, the laws of clean and unclean are only about the food that has been identified by God. Once food is identified as eligible to be eaten, now we discuss whether that particular food is properly clean or it's been made somehow unclean. You with me? Okay. Now I'm going to put together some puzzle pieces for you that hopefully might help in explaining these many questions you undoubtedly have right now concerning the relationship between sin and uncleanness, between holiness and uncleanness. And keep that word relationships in mind during this lesson, because it's going to be key to your grasping in a whole new way the method that Yehovah speaks through us through the Bible. But to get to where we need to go, I need to preface it with a discussion of languages and of styles of thinking, because these are the real barriers for us to cross so we can get to the truth. So hang in there with me. One of the more contentious debates that surrounds the Bible concerns language. That is, the currently widely held belief is that the Old Testament was originally written in Hebrew while the New Testament was first penned in Greek. There are scholars who are certain that parts of the New Testament were originally written in Hebrew or Aramaic, but were immediately translated into Greek and widely distributed in that language. But we're not going to delve into that particular argument today. Rather, we're just going to move forward with the assumption, the general assumption, the Old Testament was written in Hebrew, the New Testament in Greek, because the oldest manuscripts found for each Testament thus far, indeed, are Hebrew of the Old Testament, Greek for the New Testament. So we'll just leave that. However, that doesn't change another critical assumption, and this one is a biggie, that the Hebrews wrote the entire Bible, Old Testament and New Testament. The one possible exception was Luke, but that's debatable. Be that as it may, even if Luke was not a Hebrew, he represents but one small piece of a biblical record, and in fact, what Luke did, and he admits it, is to paste together written and personal accounts from the many Hebrews that had information on the subjects he was interested in. And that all other Bible writers were Hebrews, that has never come up against any serious academic challenge at all. That said, it makes the Bible itself a thoroughly Hebrew document. Now, does the specific culture, Hebrew, of the biblical writers even matter? Oh, you bet it does. It is a given in sociology, anthropology, linguistics, And just simple observation that language is a reflection of its culture. And that any culture is embedded in its language. When at the Tower of Babel, Yahweh divided and separated the one common language of the world into many, the result was far more reaching than simply that a whole bunch of people who suddenly had almost no way to communicate among themselves, that this was so because they'd lost the ability to each have the same language. There was more to it than just simply that. People who could still communicate among themselves, like extended families and tribes, stuck to one another, and they formed groups out of necessity. And then those groups went their separate ways, achieving the Lord's purpose of what he did at the Tower of Babel, which was to disperse the people and populate the whole globe. Now, inevitably, though, each of these language groups, now effectively divided and separated and in some cases isolated by language from the other groups, they developed their own unique concepts, ideas of life and death, morals and ethics, law and justice, priorities and values, so on and so forth. They developed into their own separate groups of nations, of cultures, each with their own language and customs and values. So language and culture are indelibly linked. Every unique culture has developed a set of philosophies and concepts that it operates upon. And many of these are totally unique only to that culture. More, the native language of that culture always develops words found only within their language, which embodies some of their one-of-a-kind cultural concepts. Therefore, some cultures have ideas and concepts that simply have no parallel in other cultures or languages. The point of this is that language and cult and the culture it represents often have concepts that are very difficult to communicate to anybody outside that culture. Because, A, there's no words that have been invented within those outside cultures to express that concept. And B, it's because it is possible that certain concepts exist only within that one culture in the first place, so there are no words. There's no reason for having words for it in other cultures and languages. My wife has a lifelong friend who is a Mexican believer. She explains that there are a number of words in the Mexican Spanish dialect for the word love. And each of these words expresses a slightly different aspect of love. The problem is, most of these Mexican words for love have no direct English equivalent, because those particular aspects of love are foreign to Americans. They only exist in the Mexican culture. So it is difficult, if not impossible, to communicate those thoughts to somebody outside of the Mexican culture. This is the crux of the problem that we have when trying to understand the Bible, when trying to comprehend what those words meant to the ancient Hebrew people who wrote them, rather than simply what they say when they're translated into a different language and applied to a different culture. It's pretty complex. But there's more. Hebrew culture in the Bible times also revolved around a certain way of thinking, a way that was common for that era, the way information is mentally processed. This was naturally reflected in their language. Hebrew. Now, of all people, it has been a most difficult challenge for me personally to even comprehend the idea that there's more than one way of thinking. My way. My wife's shaking her head to that and giving that a big amen right now. But what I mean by way of thinking is not about how humans often put their emphasis, different emphasis on various matters, or disagree on what's important or about priorities. It's a style of thinking. How conclusions are arrived at are different. Today, the vast majority of the world, certainly the Western world, uses a style of thinking that does not appear to have existed prior to the Greeks popularizing it, beginning about 450 BC. And it is a Greek style of processing information and forming conclusions that the bulk of the world, particularly the developed world, as we call it, uses today, and it's very different from the way things were before that time. Every person in this room and all the translators of the Bible going back to its very first translation in 250 BC, translated from Hebrew to a foreign language, Greek, they all think in what scholars term the rational, logical style. This is whether you realize it or not. But the biblical Hebrews, from Moses up to and including those at the time of Jesus and the apostles, did not think that way. Although by the time of Jesus, some of that thought style was starting to slip into the Jews who had gone out into the diaspora. They did not think in the rational, logical style. They operated in a style of thought called analogic. What that means for us is that often what the Hebrew writers of the Bible meant is totally obscured by the difficulty of attempting to translate analogic Hebrew thought into modern-day Western thought style by means of rational, logical-based languages like Greek, like Latin, like English. And I'm going to explain the significant difference between analogic thought of the writers of the Bible and the rational, logical thought of the Bible interpreters and of each of us. So I want to ask you to take a deep breath now, shake off the cobwebs, pay close attention to this. I can't tell you of the emails that I have received from people around the world that said this has helped them to begin to think of the Bible in a different way more than anything they've ever tried before. First, let's define rational logical thought. This is the style of thinking that we all unconsciously use because we've grown up with it. It's unlikely that any of us have ever been exposed to an alternative style of thinking, and probably wouldn't have even recognized it if we had observed it. Everything in our modern Western culture and in most of the world's cultures reflects rational logical thought, and it has for 2,000 years. And I say most because some cultures, like the Chinese and a few Asian peoples, they still incorporate analogic thought to a great deal in their culture. A well-known saying, often aimed at the Chinese, is that they're inscrutable. And that is usually mouthed by a businessman or a diplomat out of frustration in trying to communicate and deal with these Orientals. That is, we simply can't seem to understand these strange people. How they think is just a mystery to us. The point is that rational logical thought is by no means universal, nor is rational logical thought better, It's not more advanced than analogical thought. It's just different. Almost the opposite, really. It's not something whereby we made a conscious decision to choose to think in one style or another style. The rational, logical style of thought is present in all we're surrounded with, and it's taught in our culture. Rational, logical thought is embedded in science. The so-called scientific method that we were taught in grade school necessarily utilizes rational, logical thought. The two can't be separated. Rational, logical thought relies on reasoning. It operates on a philosophy as cause and effect. If I do this, that will happen. It's systemized thought. That is, it operates on the principle that everything that exists is part of a larger system. And every system is structured so that we can break it apart into smaller and smaller subsystems and examine these subsystems separately, see how they work. For instance, in the language of science, a car is a system. It's composed of many subsystems, like a motor, a transmission, a body, brakes, electrical wiring, seating, heating, air conditioning. An engine by itself can certainly be developed and examined completely outside the car. In fact, that same engine and the principles that guide its development can be used in any number of applications and systems, such as boats and trucks and airplanes and electricity generators. Alone, each of the many subsystems is complete and whole. Each is self-contained. Each one of them performs a very important function. But when we connect several of these subsystems together, presto, we have an automobile. As another example, Western medicine operates under the same rational, logical philosophy. A human body is typically looked at as a system that consists of many subsystems, like our skeletal frame, our brain, our lungs, our digestive tract, our eyes, ears, nose, throat. If we have a stomach problem, we go to a doctor who specializes on the stomach subsystem. If we break a bone, we go to a doctor that specializes on that. If we have a problem seeing, we go to an eye doctor, so on. Now, that's all well and good, but Western medicine generally does not see a soul as a separate part and subsystem of a human being. Rather, the soul is simply part of our brain function. A soul is a belief. Rationally, logically, it's really nothing more than the result of how our brain works. Rationally, logically, there is no identifiable part, subsystem of a human that can be separated out and examined and repaired, called a soul. I won't even get into the concept of a spirit, because that has no meaning in modern Western medicine. Rational, logical thought is generally broken down into two types of reasoning, inductive and deductive. Deductive reasoning operates on combining a series of hard, cold facts in order to reach a conclusion. Fact one, all dogs have four legs. Fact two, Rover is a dog. Conclusion, Rover has four legs. But inductive reasoning does not seek to achieve a mathematical certainty like deductive reasoning does. Inductive reasoning occurs when we gather bits and pieces of information together and combine it with our life experiences, with our knowledge, in order to make an observation about what seems to be true. Here's an example of inductive reasoning. Observation one, John came to class late this morning. Observation two, John's hair was messy. Experience, John's hair is usually neat and combed. What's our conclusion? John must have overslept. When we observe people, when we deal with people, We tend to use inductive reasoning to make our conclusions. Yet, whether inductive or deductive, it's all based on the rational, logical thinking style. Rational, logical thinking is linear and evolutionary. A leads to B. B leads to C. Rational, logical thinking always asks, why? Why? Rational, logical thought says, history is a straight line. It starts with some undefined point in the past, and it goes on until infinity. It's non-repeating. The past is not a predictor of the future. Patterns do not exist from a historical standpoint in rational, logical thinking. The thing about rational, logical thinking is that it operates best in a vacuum. It operates best away from relationships, away from connections to other things that might be similar or that happened previously. Truth and relevance are pragmatic. That is, in the rational logical thinking style, the question of why something happened is defined by how something happened and exactly what happened. It's a very narrow search for relevant information because it pertains to a specific event at a specific moment in time. The past, the future, they have no relevance to each other. Little, if any, relevance to the current situation. Now, what I've just described to you is what the Bible would call Greek thinking. It is the style of thinking of the Hellenists, who were at odds with the Jews. And in a few minutes, I think you're going to see why that style of thinking simply does not know what to do with the Hebrews who thought in an entirely different style, analogically. Now, before I try to explain what analogic thought is, and I repeat to you, this is the type of thought that all the writers of the Bible used. Let me state, there's nothing wrong, there's nothing ungodly per se, there's nothing faulty about rational, logical thinking. Nothing. Provided we acknowledge that it isn't the only style of thinking and it has its own built-in limitations. For instance, the universe is created by Jehovah doesn't necessarily operate in the rational, logical way, try as scholars and scientists might try to pound square pegs into round holes. Rational logical thinking is necessarily man-centered. It's totally dependent on factoring in the four dimensions that are observable to our universe: length, width, height, and time. The credo is that only things that can be scientifically observed, tested, and that those tests are repeatable, only that is real. It relies on the power of the human mind to discover and then to use those discoveries to make decisions and judgments. What cannot be proved by logic and reason is thus invalid. Now, analogic thinking. Analogic thinking is an entirely different animal. It operates based on established patterns and models. Analogic thinking searches for and recognizes common foundational truths that are shared between similar things, even though those particular similar things aren't completely alike. For instance, the operation of the wings of an airplane is to a degree like the operation of the wings of a bird or of a flying insect. Certainly beyond the ability to fly, and having some structures that stick out called wings, there are precious few similarities between birds and jets. Yet the same principles of aerodynamics are at work in both flying creatures and flying airplanes. Analogic thinking relies on relationships and on connections. For instance, notice that what we've been reading in the Torah in general, and Leviticus in particular, does not ever attempt to explain the reason for each new law or commandment or instruction. Rather, another but a similar law or instruction is just added to the mix, and then another, and then another. The relationship between all these laws and instructions creates an overall picture, and it's that that establishes the meaning. So if you're like me, and you might ask yourself, after studying Leviticus, why can't I eat pork? In reality, the answer is simply because it conforms to the underlying principle behind all the other laws. That's why. That is, the new rule is what it is for the purpose of staying in perfect relationship with all the other rules. That's why. The original Genesis pattern, therefore, becomes the context in which everything else that comes later must conform. Yeshua spoke often in a particular kind of analogic thought style called parables. A parable is a purely analogic thought style. Embodied in his sometimes puzzling parables were spiritual principles and patterns that exist, and they never changed. But he got his point across by applying principles of established and understood patterns to other things that didn't, on the surface, necessarily even seem similar. In fact, sometimes the dissimilarities were so big that people then had, and still today have, a hard time understanding the meaning of his analogies. Why? Because they didn't see the patterns that connected it all. What does a mustard seed have to do with the kingdom of heaven? Why would anybody throw valuable pearls under any circumstances to farm animals like pigs? Why would you do that? What does running out of oil to keep an oil lamp burning have to do with his returning? The answer is in the long-established spiritual principles and patterns. The thing about analogic thinking is that it must have a pre-existent original pattern from which to progress and model itself after. So the important issue in the analogic thinking style of all the biblical characters is which pattern is true and relevant to my current situation. That's how they arrived at their conclusions. Which pattern is true and relevant to my situation? Therefore, in the Greek style of thinking, the search is always for why. But in the Hebrew style of thinking, the biblical style of thinking, the search is always for which. Upon recognizing which pattern fits a particular regulation or circumstance, then the meaning of it becomes clear. Analogic thinking also tends to see things as microcosms. A microcosm simply means it's just a little world all into itself, a miniature universe that's kind of a model of a larger and more elaborate one, a family, for instance. A family is a microcosm of a community. That is, a family is just a miniature-sized group of people that is similar in principle and structure to a larger group of people called a community. Well, now that we understand the basics of the problem, let's get to the practical terms of what this means to us and to our study of the Torah. We know that Hebrew is a language embodying a culture of analogic thinking. On the other hand, Greek is a language embodying a culture of rational, logical thinking. Hebrew is a completely separate culture with a completely separate and unique language that was designed to communicate the Hebrew's unique concepts. And the Hebrew concepts, as we see in the Bible, are based on the mind of God and the information He gave to them and them alone in the form of the Torah and then later on other scriptures. Greek is a widespread and variant culture with a unique language that was designed to communicate its particular cultural concepts and principles. Greek culture is based on human discovery, human philosophy, science, technology, man-made systems of morality, and truth-finding. How does a Greek system of thinking and problem-solving, a rational, logical system, extract truth and meaning from an entirely opposite system of thinking? How do you do that? How do Hebrew concepts that existed only in the minds of Hebrews that were born of a Hebrew culture, therefore expressed by a Hebrew language, how do those get communicated to the minds of men and women like us who dwell in a Greek culture which doesn't even have these same concepts, nor do we have a vocabulary in our own tongue that in many cases describes them and communicates them? The answer is not very well. Now, is Hebrew somehow good and Greek somehow bad? Is Hebrew godly and Greeks ungodly? No, not at all. God created all language. In fact, He absolutely forced language variation on the human race. The Tower of Babel. And as Dr. Robert McGee once pointed out to me, God knew and He had good reason to allow the New Testament to hit the streets running in the Greek language. As imperfect as it might be to properly illuminate those many Hebrew concepts that it was brought to illuminate. So our task in Torah class, and it's my passion, is to figure out just how we can look at the Bible through our hopelessly rational, logical eyes and extract a meaning that was originally formulated in analogic thought, language, and culture. Now, believe me, that's a task. I have no doubt, though, it can be done to a great degree. But, see, here's the thing. It takes a willingness to let go of false doctrines and traditions that were created by rational, logical, thinking men who despised the Hebrews and Israel. Men who could not bear the thought of bending and trying to approach the Hebrew Scriptures and even the New Testament from the different mindset of those who actually wrote it. This would have involved validating the Jewish culture, the Jewish thought style, something that by the middle to the late second century was unthinkable for the Gentile-controlled church that wanted no form of Jewishness to remain within it. We're going to conclude this week and move on into Leviticus chapter 12 next time.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.